Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
As a young mayor of San Antonio, Leon Castro was a phenom in American politics with a compelling personal story. He became known nationally when he delivered the keynote speech at the 2012 Democratic Convention. And then he was a cabinet member under President Obama and emerged as one of the contenders for vice president on the ticket with Hillary Clinton in 2016. A few days after he left office, I had a chance to sit down with Secretary Castro to talk about his experiences and where he sees American politics going in the next few years. Some of the references you'll hear will reflect where politics was in early February when we recorded this conversation, but most of his observations are very relevant right now. Julian Castro, welcome to the Axe Files, but also back to the Institute of Politics, where you've been on the board and where your brother serves on the board now. We appreciate that.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you guys are unique in that you're identical twins and have made this big impact in politics, but you sort of couldn't help it, it seems like, given the way that you were raised. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and first, thanks for having me. It's great to be here, and congrats on the way that you've built up this Institute of Politics in such a short time. So my brother Joaquin and I are twins, well, born 1 minute apart. I am older than he is. He says I'm a minute.
That's how you got to be mayor.
That's right. I jumped into politics before he did. His running joke is that I'm a minute uglier than he is. I used to, in D.C., I used to tell people that the way to tell us apart was that I'm the Castro in Washington with a real job, since he's in Congress. These days, he says that he's the Castro with a job, since I'm unemployed. But yeah, we grew up with a mother, especially our mom, that was very, very active in politics. She never held office herself, but she was involved in the old Chicano movement of the late 1960s and 70s. She ran for city council in San Antonio.
Talk about her life.
Yeah, she was born in San Antonio. She had grown up with her mom, been raised by my grandmother as a single parent. My grandmother had come from Mexico when she was about 6 years old, and she came because she and her sister had been orphaned. Her parents had passed away in Mexico, and the nearest relatives that could take them in were in San Antonio. So they came through Eagle Pass, Texas, in 1922, and my grandmother ended up with this extended family. They pulled her out of school to help with the housework when she was in third or fourth grade, so she never finished even elementary school. She ended up learning how to read. She could speak both English and Spanish, and she raised my mom as a single parent. My mother didn't have much interaction with her dad when she was growing up. My grandmother worked as a maid, a cook, and a babysitter for her whole life. That's what she did. And she was not very political. So my mother was basically a child of the 60s, this hellraiser who graduated from high school in 1965. She went to Catholic school for all of those 13 years, starting in kindergarten, and then went to a Catholic university and got involved in the Young Democrats, and then got involved in the Chicano movement.
In San Antonio at that time was a town that was going through a lot of political turmoil because you had a large Latino population, but not represented in the politics of the city.
No doubt. There was, this tension in the city. You had a groundbreaking congressman named Henry B. Gonzalez that I think was one of either the first or second Mexican-American congressman elected. And obviously, Texas being the state that it was at the time, you had limited opportunities, just like you did in much of the rest of the United States, for Mexican-Americans and Latinos in general. When my grandmother was growing up, you could walk across storefronts, and I've seen these signs that said, no Mexicans or dogs allowed. And of course, by the time my mother grew up, it was better. There was some progress that had been made, but you still had a very high dropout rate. You had underinvestment in primarily Latino and African-American neighborhoods in San Antonio. And so the prospects for young people of my mother's age who were Latina or Latino was not what it could be. And there was a real frustration with that. And I think it got tied up completely also back then into the anti-war movement and the general activism that was going on. And that bug bit my mom. She ran for city council when she was 23 in San Antonio.
But not as a Democrat, right? She challenged the Democrat.
It was nonpartisan back then for city elections. Mm-hmm. But she ran under a slate called the Committee for Barrio Betterment. And I still have the poster, her campaign poster from 1971. And their slogan was, give government back to the people. It was a very grassroots-oriented effort, really focused on making investments in older neighborhoods and rundown neighborhoods, focused on giving more opportunity to everyone, not leaving people out. But at that time, San Antonio, like most big American cities, did not have single member districts. So, it didn't matter how popular you were in one neighborhood or one ward or segment, you couldn't afford to run citywide, couldn't get support citywide, then it didn't matter. And nobody that ran on her slate won. There was at least
one. Did they dominate in Latino?
Yeah, so they. She did well, and one or two of the others did well enough that an analysis afterward showed that if there had been single-member districts, there were one or two districts where she could have won and been elected. She was never elected. She only ran that one time, but my brother and I were born 3 years later in 74. And you can imagine that we grew up getting dragged to speeches and rallies and organizational meetings. She was active in different women's issues. She continued to volunteer for campaigns. I remember.
How'd she make a living?
So she worked at a couple of different nonprofits, and then she worked for several years at the city of San Antonio and then at the Housing Authority. She worked at one of the community colleges. And there was a time also after that period of activism, and I'm sure that other folks went through this during that time, where I think she was penalized for being as outspoken as she was and taking on the establishment in that area. There are a lot of people, you see this even today in different contexts. If you rock the boat too much, you may not be the first candidate for a job at a company or somewhere else that wants a safe bet. And I think that she suffered from some of that. But she made it work. She and my grandmother, because mm-hmm. after the age of 8, we grew up with both of them.
Right. Your dad left the home. He was a teacher?
Yeah, he was a teacher. He started off early on. He had graduated from the public schools there in San Antonio and then gone and gotten his bachelor's degree at UT. And in the early 60s, he graduated. He became a math teacher. And my mother and father were never married. I guess they were common law married because they were together for 10 or 11 years. After the age of 8, my brother Joaquin and I grew up with my mother and my grandmother.
Do you remember, do you have memories of these rallies and events? I mean, are they?
Yeah, some of it, mostly negative. You know, because who in the world wants to go when you're 9 years old or 10 years old to, you know, one of these speeches or rallies? I remember sitting for 3 hours in this the main library in San Antonio while the adults talked about who knows what, you know, organizing. And I was just ready to leave, you know. That was part of the reason that I actually did not like politics. If you had asked me at 15, did I think that I would get involved in politics, I would have said, no way. Yeah, I didn't see the point. I thought that it was boring. I did not see that for myself.
Huh, interesting. She did, she was instrumental in the movement that ultimately led to the election of the first Latino mayor of San Antonio, Henry Cisneros.
Yeah, she and other folks were involved with collecting the data and putting the argument together that eventually led to the creation of single-member districts in that city. And, you know, former Mayor Cisneros was first elected to City Council District 1 in San Antonio and then, you know, reelected a couple of times. Eventually, in 1981, he became the first Latino mayor of a major American city. Very inspirational, meant a lot for the folks growing up during that time. My brother and I grew up in
the 80s. You were, what, seven? How old were you?
Yeah, when he was elected, I would have been six, going on seven.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember that election, but I remember, you know, a few years on and all of the aspirations that were tied into Henry's rise. And to this day, we're friends. Obviously, he eventually served as HUD secretary, and
right.
I served as mayor and then as HUD secretary.
Yeah.
And I still...
Is he a mentor?
Yeah, I mean, he's been somebody who has offered advice consistently, mm-hmm. and a good friend through the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I still call him for advice. I was on the phone with him a couple of weeks ago. But when I was growing up, there was a significance in being able to say, you know, that Henry is in that position. And look, he looks like me. And if he can do that, I can do that. And so I think that he had that kind of impact at the time on a lot of us who were growing up in San Antonio.
But you say your interest in politics came later. You went off, you and, yeah, I was interested. I read somewhere that you guys went to night school to get out of high school more quickly.
Yeah, we graduated in 3 years from high school by going to night school and like, summer school.
Why?
I don't know. You're just in a hurry to get the hell out of there. You know, just people say that high school, you know, you always hear that high school is those are the best years of your life. That's not true for me. You know, I mean, first of all, in high school, I was fairly quiet. I'm still not the loudest person out there.
Yeah, you're kind of an unlikely politician.
That's right. Yeah, you know, my brother's a little bit more extroverted than I am, but he's not that much more extroverted. Neither one of us is the most boisterous person or most talkative person. But in high school, yeah, I used to talk to two or three people during the day, and my brother was one of them. Just to give you a sense of how social I was. So I didn't, you know.
So not exactly student council president, huh?
No, you know, I was involved in different things and played sports, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't the life of the party.
When you're you were raised really by your grandmother and your mother. So how did that impact on you growing up in that household that was sort of a matriarchy? How did that shape your...
You know, I think it was fascinating. And now as a parent, I look back on it. My mom was very liberal, not just in her views, but in how she parented. I remember Joaquin and I, when we were 9 years old, taking the bus downtown. We didn't have a car at the time. We took the bus downtown and watched in the summer of 1984... We probably watched The Karate Kid like six times and other movies. And, you know, she would just let us go. And we would watch horror movies and eat junk food. And she let us stay up pretty much as late as we wanted to.
So the basic message here is if you're a parent out there,
yeah,
let them do whatever the hell they want.
I don't even do that now as a parent to my kids. However, I think that the magic of it was that with our homework and other things, she actually somehow, and I still don't know how, I've asked her, but she got us to self-discipline and to want to succeed and to do well in school and to finish our homework and do the things that you should do without a heavy hand or spanking us or being
very strict. Your grandmother play a role in that?
Yeah, she did. But, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, she was as liberal as my mom. Well, I mean, not in her political views.
Yeah, maybe, but in her parenting
style. But, yeah,
style.
I mean, they were just – you asked about, you know, growing up with these two women in the household. They gave us a lot of latitude. But at the same time, it was a household that was very full of respect and a sense that we had real worth and that you had to make something out of that. And also that you should do something for other people too. And so somehow, you know, it all worked out. The other thing that I think helped was that I was a twin. I'm convinced that I wouldn't be where I'm at if I hadn't had Joaquin. Because for those of the folks listening that are twins, or if you have twins or siblings that are twins, you know that it's a very unique relationship. And we were each other's best friend. Growing up, we were very competitive. And so I think that competition between us fueled each other to do better, both in school and in sports. And I'm not sure that I would have left my own devices in this house that was very lenient. I'm not sure what would have happened, but having Joaquin there sort of tempered that.
Did it make a difference that you were identical? I mean, does it create, that creates, I know it created a political problem for you once when you got, when.
Yeah. When my opponent said that we tried to switch with each other. Yeah.
Yes. But, and we actually had these twins here in politics in Chicago, the Shaw brothers. One was in the legislature, one was in the city council, and they used to fill in for each other from time to time.
Yeah.
So it's not unheard of in American in American politics. But I'm just wondering, being a twin, being an identical twin versus being a twin, does that have any particular nuance to it?
Well, I think that growing up, it makes a difference in the sense that you're always compared to each other because you walk through the world looking the same way, having so many of the same experiences as you grow up, that your identity is formed in some ways in comparison and in contrast to your twin brother or twin sister.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was true with Joaquin and me. So, you know, one of us is the quieter one and one of us is the louder one. One of us was better at school and one of us was better at sports. I was better at school. But so your identity is probably formed in relation to another person more than somebody out there in the general public that just has siblings or is an only child.
And then you guys went to college together at Stanford?
Yeah.
You had said somewhere, I think movingly about the fact that you were the beneficiary of affirmative action, which, you know, has been an ongoing issue, certainly in the state of Texas.
Yeah, for sure.
It's been an issue and maybe an issue again now with a potentially reconstituted Supreme Court. What should people know about your experience?
In college or at Stanford? Or
with affirmative action.
Yeah, well, you know, a few years ago, I was doing an interview for the New York Times Magazine, and I told the author, you know, if you're going to have this policy in place, then people should be straightforward about the benefits and the disadvantages. And I said, you know, I feel like that affirmative action may have helped me get into Stanford and that at the time, my SAT score was a little bit underneath what I think the median matriculating student, the student that was going there. Now, I think my grades and the other stuff was right up there, mm-hmm. you know, did very well. But, you know, that may have been one benefit of affirmative action. But the part of the story that he did not write about, which I told him, was that when I took the LSAT 4 years later to get into law school, that I scored higher than the median matriculating Stanford student that was going to law school. And my point of it was that that policy had helped ensure that for some folks who had gone to schools that had been underinvested in, and you know, you had a headwind, that it gave him a shot to compete with everybody else for the first time on a stage. And that in my case, when I was able to compete, then a few years down the road, then I actually had excelled and done better than a lot of folks, done better than the average. And I think that that's the way that that thing should have worked, that people are given a chance and then it's up to you to make something of that. I know that there's a lot of debate right now. It's probably going to go back to the Supreme Court. And I certainly think that, you know, for my kids, for instance, that they should not be the beneficiaries of an affirmative action program because they're going to have all the benefits in the world, right? But I do think that there was a value in that, and that as states grapple with the approach they're going to take, that they need to be careful to maintain opportunities for folks who have faced headwinds.
We're going to be right back with Julian Castro. I want to follow up on the affirmative action point you just made, because you said something that I've heard Barack Obama say, which is my kids don't need the benefit of affirmative action. They've had all the benefits. Almost exactly the same words that you've said. So how should these programs be constructed? Because the other half of the affirmative action discussion is that it is good for the campus community at large to have a diverse student body. So it's not just the interest of the student, but the interests of the campus at large. So how do you construct these programs in a way that that account for the fact that your kids have advantages? Barack Obama's kids have advantages. There are other kids who don't. And also that there are kids in rural Texas, for example, whose schools are also under-financed and under-resourced, who face headwinds as well.
Well, and I think that a couple of things. Number one, it points out that you need a process that is nuanced. Folks say, you know, we don't want quotas. And I think that that's absolutely right, that you don't want any kind of quota system. That remember, the idea is supposed to be that if all things being equal, when you're trying to select a class and make it diverse, because as you noted, I think institutions recognize that there's a value, especially educational institutions, in diversity, in the student body reflecting the larger society, and so that students themselves can get better prepared for the world that they're going to encounter. But any process of affirmative action needs to take into account the headwinds or the challenges that different people have faced. And I think in the years since I went to college, one of the things that I have more of an appreciation of are the different ways in life that people face those challenges. You know, if you're somebody that is poor in East Texas, rural East Texas, or you're somebody that is growing up with a disability, folks have these life experiences that create headwinds. And I think any process that we put in place, that you have in place, ought to consider that, you know, the different ways that people have overcome. Because that was the idea, I think, in the first place behind affirmative action. I will say, though, at the same time, that if you're a young African American growing up right now in Chicago or Philadelphia, that we can't pretend that from the beginning it is often much more difficult to get to those same heights. Like the deck isn't still too oftentimes stacked against folks. And so that I think is a reason to keep some way, whether you call it affirmative action or something else, some way to offer opportunity to folks who are overcoming challenges and who are overcoming bias, and to do it in a way that is respectful and that is nuanced and that also adds to the experience of the students in those universities.
Are you worried that is not going to be the case? Given the political change of
parties and so on? Yeah, I'm worried that folks will pretend like we've made all the progress in this country that we need to make. And as the president said very eloquently when he spoke at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 2015.
You're talking about President Obama.
President Obama, that's right. Yes. President Obama said when he spoke at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge at Selma to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, you can't deny that we've made a lot of progress. But folks also can't deny that we still have a lot to go. And so I do think that there's a place for making sure that folks who have to overcome these legacy challenges, that they get opportunity.
Let me ask you a question. This always comes up relative to you and Joaquin. Given your history and given the nature of San Antonio and so on, and given how obviously bright you are. I think I read that you studied Japanese or something. Mm-hmm. What about Spanish?
Yeah, that does come up a lot. So when we were growing up, my grandmother spoke Spanish, and my mom speaks Spanish decently, but mostly around the house, they spoke English, and my grandmother would watch her telenovelas on Univision or Telemundo. And so I grew up hearing Spanish, some Spanish, but I think my mother had also come from a generation where, she was slapped on the wrist with a ruler, and her classmates were if they heard you speaking Spanish. So she came from a generation that wanted to make sure that her children learned English, too. And I think that just became the dominant language that we spoke. And so I understand, people often write about this or they talk about this and they act like Joaquin and I, that if you're not fluent in Spanish, that you speak zero. I speak some Spanish and I understand it decently. I'm just not fluent at it. So I can get by. I'm just not fluent at it. But, when I went through the vice presidential process, every other article or maybe, 80% of them had that in there, And
well, Tim Kaine is a fluent Spanish speaker and got the job, So I'm
that
just
is
saying.
To his credit,
You mentioned you worked at a law firm. You worked at a celebrated Texas law firm, Akin Gump, and Bob Strauss, who is sort of a legendary figure in American politics and in Texas politics, was the former chair of the Democratic National Committee, was there. Was he around at the time?
No, we were there in the San Antonio office and it had been a Dallas-based firm, but yes. By the time we got there, it was really the power base was in Washington, D.C. But yeah, he and Vernon Jordan, this group of folks who have just been, very big into Democratic politics over the years. I was there a little over a year and a half and then I left because there was an issue where one of the clients had an interest before the city council and they wanted to develop this golf course over the aquifer recharge zone. So San Antonio relies for its drinking water on an underground aquifer. They wanted to put a golf course on the area where that recharges and I wanted to vote against it, but I couldn't do that. They were a client of the firm and so one day in January of 2002, I just walked into one of the partners' offices and told them that I was quitting. And I enjoyed my time at the firm and so forth. But for me, that was a very important moment because it was a decision about whether I was going to be honest with myself in public service and maintain my integrity, or I was going to keep making the money that was very good at that law firm. And you know, I was only 27 years old, I think, at the time, but I had just bought a house and I had a car, and eventually, you know, we started our own little law firm and so forth, but my house almost went into foreclosure. Little by little, I climbed out of that, but you know, I still think about that time and that it was worth it.
Yeah, that was in the days when conflicts of interest were an issue.
Yeah, I often have a good chuckle about that, considering what we're seeing in D.C. right now.
You ran for mayor, 31 years old, and you run for mayor.
For 30, yeah. I was trying to become the youngest elected mayor. There had been a guy at the age of 28, I think, in the 1800s that had been appointed mayor. But I was trying to become the youngest elected mayor, and there was a guy that I was running against who was 70 and trying to become the second oldest elected mayor. And we went into a runoff, and he won in a very close runoff. And he actually turned out to be a good mayor for the city.
Well, it sounds like it's good that he won, because you had a lot more time to achieve your goal than he probably did.
But, that's right.
By the way, does the word driven mean anything to you? It sounds like you were pretty driven from the start.
By the time when
you had researched the fact that you wanted to become the second youngest mayor, I mean, that's serious ambition.
Yeah, you know, by the time I got to law school, I thought that I would probably go back and get into politics. And I think people are generally all right with that, as long as you're straightforward with folks about your vision and why you're running. And also,
there's an element of you coming back, having gotten this gilded education and wanting to serve was probably an appealing thing.
For sure. And I think growing up with my mother and what she had done, I had a sense that I knew that I could not be happy just working at the law firm and just billing those hours on stuff that I fundamentally did not care one way or the other about. That, and so getting into public service in a way was, at the beginning, a compromise with myself to feel like I was doing something for other people as well, to make a difference. The other thing is, David, as you know, you've been around a lot of politicians. I mean, people are lying if they say that there's no ego involved.
Yes.
I think just about every politician has some amount of ego. You want a little bit of the glory of, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, so yeah, of course, that is a part of it. But I think the best people in public service, it's a lot more of, okay, why are you in it? You're in it to serve people, and you measure your success by how well you're serving people. You don't measure the success by, you know, how loud the applause is or how many dinners you get invited to or how much the press loves you and all that stuff.
Yeah. I'm sure that at some point you wish you were invited to a few less dinners. Hard to avoid.
I've eaten a lot of chicken over the years.
So when you were mayor, you had a couple of major initiatives. What are the things that you're proudest of, and what did you learn during those 5 years as mayor?
Well, the things that I'm proudest of were, first, that we had a ballot initiative in San Antonio to expand high-quality pre-K in the city, because there was a gap of young people who were not getting pre-K. And we took it to the ballot.
Raised taxes, right? Sales
we
taxes.
We raised the sales tax and by an eighth of a cent, and we made it happen. The voters passed it with 53%. Some folks were worried because they thought, this is Texas. It may not pass. But I thought that it was important to make that investment because, as I've often said, I believe that brain power is the new currency of success in the 21st century. And San Antonio has lagged behind, tremendously behind over the years.
And what difference has that made?
Well, number one, I think that it's given folks confidence that we're on a better trajectory in terms of
for the kids themselves.
Well, for the kids, more prepared as they get into kindergarten, more likely to do well on those third grade tests.
And you've seen that already.
It's a very big year this year because the first cohort of pre-K for SA students is going to take their third grade tests. Uh-huh. So, you know, this is being measured. We will look at the outcomes, but all of the research, in fact, the groundbreaking research on this was, I think, done in Chicago years and years ago that showed that it does have a significant impact.
Yeah, I have no doubt about it. I mean, I think early childhood education is probably the greatest investment that we can make. You know, the brain develops at a very early age, and if you can get an early start, it makes, I think, demonstrably has made it. But I'm just interested whether you've seen it, whether you've seen it there. You also did a lot of work in trying to revitalize the inner city there, the core inner city there.
Yeah, that was the other passion that I had. Yeah, I had grown up in the city. I had seen there were a lot of areas of the city that had been neglected, particularly the east side of San Antonio, which was a traditionally African-American part of the city, and then now is African-American, Hispanic, and white. It really is a diverse place, but still underinvested in. And then downtown, 80 miles up the road, Austin had this renaissance in the downtown area, and San Antonio, even though it has the Riverwalk, which is beautiful, had not had the same success. And the
Spurs, by the way.
That's also beautiful. Definitely a great team. But that was a good example there. AT&T Center had been built out on the east side, but not really connected to anything. And it was built away from the Alamo Dome, outside of the downtown area. And so there was not the connectivity, the momentum, the housing, the transit. And we wanted to focus on all of that to create greater prosperity for folks across the community.
We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back with Julian Castro. You passed on an opportunity to join the Obama cabinet. You were approached about becoming transportation secretary. Why'd you turn that job down?
Well, they were never specific about the role, but that was probably, I would imagine, what it was. I turned it down because it just didn't feel like the right time. You know, I sat down with the president the day after his second inauguration, and we discussed it. And but it just wasn't the right time for me. We had just passed pre-K for SA. I felt like I had a lot of good things happening in San Antonio. And when I got into politics, leading that city was really what I wanted to do. That's what I had looked forward to. And so I felt like things were going great, and that moment wasn't the right moment. When he called, I guess about 15 months later, I just felt like I was in a different place. And
he talked to you about HUD.
Yeah, he was specifically talking about that. And I had these two passions as mayor: improving educational achievement and revitalizing the certain communities, neighborhoods. And HUD dealt with one of those passions, whereas transportation did not.
What was the experience of moving from San Antonio into Washington and taking over this agency in some freighted political times here, very divided?
Overall, it was a tremendous experience. I would definitely do it again. The thing that I got out of HUD was this deep sense of the big difference that those programs make in the lives of people who are just trying to get a fair shot. And oftentimes, people misperceive them, folks who live in public housing or assisted housing. Yeah, Americans like everyone else in small towns and big cities that are striving, and the boost that HUD's programs give them make it more likely that they're going to be able to achieve their own dreams. And there's a lot of satisfaction from that. The other part was that I got to visit 100 different communities in 39 states. So I got to see a lot more than I ever did as mayor. I got to see the country and the neat things that cities and towns are doing out there. Sometimes the folks that are doing things the wrong way. I learned a lot more about our nation. The challenges were, number one, there's something special about being mayor of a city that you kind of feel like you have the wind at your back and people on both sides of the aisle, because there's an esprit de corps about the city, the community.
Right, the community.
You want jobs, investment. Yeah, you know, I mean, you want the trash to be picked up well.
Plus, you can see what you do every day.
That's
when you're mayor of the city, you can go out and you can see the problems and the possibilities and the impact of what you do in a way that's very hard when you're running a huge federal agency.
No doubt. No doubt. In fact, you know, some of the most enjoyable moments for me really were the ones on the road, where I actually got to go to the housing development or go do the point in time count, where we talk to folks who are homeless and try and make sure that we have an accurate count so we can serve them. The experiential part of it The other challenge is, of course, it's Washington, D.C., and so you're in an ecosystem where you're at the mercy of a lot of moving parts, and most especially the Congress.
Or not moving parts.
Yeah, that's probably a better way to put it.
Yeah.
And HUD could do a lot more than it is doing now if it had the resources. Right now, HUD only serves one out of every four Americans that qualify for its programs. In 1981, when Ronald Reagan walked in the door, HUD had something like 16,000 employees. Today, it has less than 8,000. So this idea that everything in the federal government, now I know that there are parts of it that have grown significantly, but that everything has grown, that's not true. If you indexed community development block grants, for instance, CDBG, from their level in 1978, 1980, they would be several times higher than the $3 billion outlay that you get today.
Mm-hmm.
So I inherited a department that, while still doing tremendous work, really is not resourced at the level to meet the needs out there in the country.
Well, we're sitting here on the south side of Chicago, and that need is very obvious in communities around here. But you know, because you come from a state with large cities and rural areas, the tension between rural areas and cities, oh, and the perception that, you know, these programs are sort of giveaways for people in cities, for minorities, and so on. What's the pushback on that argument?
The pushback is that, you know, we can go through just example of investments that HUD makes in rural America and smaller towns. One of the places I visited was in rural Wisconsin with Sean Duffy, the congressman from Wisconsin, to talk about the investments that HUD was making in that area and what else we could do.
And what kind of investments were they?
Well, you know, on homelessness, on CDBG. Every state gets CDBG that mostly goes, when it goes to the state capital, it mostly goes to smaller areas.
To help with community development projects.
Yeah. We have in the nation about 3,300, maybe a little bit more than that now, but let's say about 3,300 housing authorities. And the majority of them, the vast majority of them, are smaller housing authorities, many of them in small towns. So this idea that, and I often said that, you know, HUD is only those big cities. I often said that you could really call it the Department of Housing and Community Development.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, when you name a department Housing and Urban Development, you can see why people in rural areas would say, well, this has nothing to do with me.
For sure. I remember, in fact, that one of the folks who called me right after I was announced as a nominee for HUD was Bill Clinton. And President Clinton, the very first piece of advice that he gave me, we talked for about 45 minutes, was go to places where they don't expect that HUD has anything for them, that HUD has anything to
Smart.
Do with them,
yeah.
And show them that, in fact, HUD does have something to do with them. And so, you know, I tried to keep that in mind, and we made some of those trips. And you know, one of the most poignant trips I made was to Pine Ridge in South Dakota, the Indian Reservation, and saw how many people were living in a four-bedroom house, like 17 or 18 people, including two families that were living in the basement. So that department that Ben Carson now is in charge of does make a big difference in places big and small.
I want to get to Dr. Carson and the new administration. Just a couple of minutes on how we got to this point, because you talk about Bill Clinton giving you advice to go to places where people didn't expect you to go. Do you think Hillary Clinton should have gone to more places where people didn't expect her to go?
Well, I mean, I think that, number one, that hindsight is 2020, but probably—
I know, but I'm asking you for hindsight.
So I mean, if you—
You're exempt here.
Given that we know what the results were, sure. I think that if they could replay that they themselves would say they should have spent a little bit more time in smaller towns in Wisconsin.
Maybe up there
Ohio.
In Duffy's district.
That's right. And Pennsylvania, even though I know in Pennsylvania, I think that was a little bit different because they had that pretty well covered. But sure. And I believe that one of the challenges for the Democratic Party over the next 2 to 4 years and beyond is to get out to those places. Because on the issues and what the Democratic Party stands for, there shouldn't be much daylight between us and the folks who live out there. And there was a time, Texas is a good example, when that there was a connection, not only because of the traditional leanings of the South, but also on labor issues, on the need to invest in smaller communities. So
traveling around, do you, in these smaller communities and talking to people, do you get Donald Trump's appeal to those voters when he said the system's rigged against you, and I'm gonna help you. You're not respected. You're forgotten.
Yeah, I think that he spoke to folks in a way that was appealing, even though it wasn't always given its due during the campaign. I think many folks, I'll include myself in this, didn't see the impact that it was having. I can understand why folks would be attracted to that message. As much economic progress as we've made in the nation, you still do have very significant challenges. You think about the fact that a lot of these towns have suffered from job losses, factories closing down. I remember going to Ohio during the campaign and hearing about a factory that had just closed like 6 months before. And you could feel in the little meeting that we had this sense of, okay, well, what are y'all going to do about it? So I understand it. Sure.
Doesn't the Democratic Party have to have answers to those questions? Answers to those questions. I'm not talking about the 100 programs that you could find on Hillary Clinton's website, but a kind of deep, passionate understanding of those concerns and a plan to deal with a world in which not China and Mexico, but robots and computers are taking people's jobs and will at an increasing pace.
That's right. Well, number one is that I think among the many things that are disappointing about the result of the election is that, you know, if you looked at what Hillary was actually proposing to do, she had her act together on how to address these issues much more than Donald Trump ever did. So Trump was a much better messenger, and he got the opening there and what folks wanted to hear. But Clinton was much more thoughtful about what we could do. You hit the nail on the head with one of them, which is that it's not just this issue of trade. It's really an issue about automation, and that there are millions of jobs that go unfilled right now because of the skills gap. And so what are we doing, and how are we tailoring our entire education system to train folks to be able to take on these jobs that go unfilled? And the Democratic Party has to take all of that and give it a powerful message that reflects the experience that people are going through.
Of course, if you're a 55-year-old guy and you've been mining coal all your life, the whole notion of retraining for some job that you can't see is not necessarily a compelling thing.
No, that's true. And you know, as a former mayor, I would say that you always have to go to where your strengths are. And so it's not realistic to expect that every community is going to be steeped in high tech or that they're going to get automotive manufacturing or something to completely replace what they've had. But you have to figure out, based on your assets and how that looks going into the future, okay, well, what can you build on? And I think that if mayors and governors out there can do anything, it's to get deeply into that kind of asset mapping process and figure out plans, concrete plans to build on those assets. Some have been better at others, I think, at doing that.
Have you had any detailed conversation with Ben Carson? I don't think I have to review who he is. He's your successor, obviously. Gained great notoriety as a brain surgeon, but running HUD isn't necessarily brain surgery. So what did you have you had conversations with him?
We had one conversation just before the holidays over the phone. And four or five minutes. It was fairly high level, very pleasant. But at the time,
High level, you mean generality?
Yeah, it was not detailed. He did not ask, and we did not go into any of HUD's programs or policies. you know, of course, we offered after that to meet with him if he wanted to. I think that most of the nominees on Trump's team had their own process to get ready for confirmation hearings, and so that did not happen.
What about at the staff level? Did your staff confer with his?
Definitely. There was a landing team that, and on our end, the Obama administration was very well prepared. Prepared papers, prepared briefings, and they did go through that.
Mm-hmm. And what is your sense of what's your level of confidence about that department moving forward?
You know, like everybody, I am hopeful, because I think that traditionally, whether you've had a Republican or a Democrat, most folks have gone in there and they've recognized the value of the programs that HUD administers and the tremendous impact they make in the lives of everyday Americans. At the same time, I do have some concerns, for instance, on fair housing. We did a groundbreaking new rule called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing, essentially to try and make sure that communities are more thoughtful about the landscape of opportunity and how they ensure that everyone has opportunity, and also work to desegregate. And I think it's an open question how that's going to be approached.
Do you think Carson, you know, much has been made of the fact that he grew up in the housing projects in Detroit? In the inner city of Detroit. Yeah. Let me pull back from that. Do you think that gives him some special insight that would be useful as secretary of this department?
Oh, no doubt. That's a useful insight. You know, life experience is one of the things that I do think is useful. So that is certainly something that I hope that he will rely upon, that experience. My hope is that that'll be channeled in a positive way. In other words, I think that there's a risk that we scapegoat these folks. I have never believed that folks who live in public housing are lazy. I don't believe that just because somebody is poor, that they're lazy or that they don't want to work or that they can't achieve their dreams. I also don't believe that it's the case that government assistance necessarily breeds reliance on it.
So you're worried that he may use his story as a way of saying, pull yourself up by your bootstraps sort of thing?
Yeah, and I think we all should work toward reducing intergenerational poverty. You want folks to be able to, you know, if they're on government assistance, eventually get off. But I do think that you can go overboard with that. And my hope is that they will strike the right balance there.
One thing you did on the way out the door was you cut the FHA mortgage fee to try and reduce the cost of owning a home for people who get FHA loans. That apparently was reversed in the first days of the Trump administration. What's the impact of that? And were you surprised by it?
I wasn't necessarily surprised. So we, in January of 2015, we lowered for the first time in the Obama administration the mortgage insurance premium of the FHA. Basically, this is how much you have to pay to the FHA to get its insurance. FHA is important because it allows somebody to put 3.5% down. And oftentimes, folks who are buying a home for the first time, working class folks, middle class folks. Because of the housing crisis, because FHA's finances had not been as strong as they needed to be, over several years from 08 upward, though that mortgage fee had been increased over and over. And we finally had gotten to a point where the fund, the Mutual Mortgage Insurance Fund, was stable and it was strong. And so we reduced it for the first time, and then we did it again in January of 2017. It would have meant a $500 savings to the average FHA-insured borrower.
For a $200,000 home.
That's right. So that means in some places it was more than that. Mm-hmm. You know, again, these are folks who are working class. They're very responsible. The FHA made adjustments that mean that it's responsible folks who are getting these. The default rate is at one of its lowest levels in decades. And, you know, it's unfortunate that they reversed that, because it would have meant something good for these folks to be able to achieve the American dream, who are hardworking and who are responsible.
Finally, you you said in a an interview the day after the election, it's up to Trump more than anybody to make sure he approaches the presidency differently from how he approached the campaign. Being president isn't like being a campaigner. One of the things he benefited from was very, very low expectations. Do you think now we're a few weeks into the Trump administration, do you think he got that message? What's your sense of the rollout here?
Yeah, for him, the positive case would be that to his base, it looks like he's fulfilling promises. But I think the larger impression that folks are getting is one of an incompetent administration. So that's one thing. Very sloppy. This so-called Muslim ban, or de facto Muslim ban, was a perfect example of this. I said very publicly on issues that it doesn't matter whether you're super liberal or super conservative or somewhere in between, you cannot just take an ideology and then dump that into policy implementation. You have to be able to operationalize policy. And what they did was that they just took an ideology, keep these people out, and they dumped that into the operational system of the Department of Homeland Security and everybody else. And it turned into a terrible mess. He has a third string level of folks around him. And so you can see that even though it looks like, okay, he may be getting some political mileage out of quote unquote keeping his promises, it's being done in a very amateurish way, very sloppy.
And what about the wall and this face off with the president of Mexico over the wall? And his general approach to immigration from Mexico. You come from a town not far from the border. What's your sense of that and where we're headed in that with relationships with Mexico?
You know, I grew up in San Antonio, where it's very clear the benefits of a strong relationship with our neighbor to the south. Economic relationship, the familial relationships that still exist, way that Mexico has been helpful over the years, in terms of whether it's been diplomatically or are working to stem the flow of drugs or migrants. There's a strong relationship there that unfortunately the president is taking a jackhammer to. And even if you believe in the wall, there would be a way to pursue it. You know, in fact, there is some fencing right now. Now, I don't agree with a wall, but I think one of the stronger arguments that folks can make is, hey, look, you know, you already have part of this border that has a fence on it. So we've kind of already done some of it. Well, okay.
But we paid for that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Let me grant that. Saying that Mexico is going to have to pay for it is, to me, just strikes me as a way to humiliate the other country. And doing it in a way that inflames that country, and given the history of United States and Mexico relations. The other thing was that for the Latino community, it continues this narrative about Donald Trump that he really, you know, what I would hear is people would say, you know, he doesn't like us. Not we don't like him. During the campaign, people would say over and over, why doesn't he like us? You tie this to what he said about that Judge Gurriel, who was born in Indiana, and he said that he couldn't do his job properly because he was of Mexican descent. And Paul Ryan called it a textbook case of racism and so forth. There's this very strong narrative that there's just something up with him in the Latino community. He's just done. And then he didn't put a Latino in the cabinet. Okay.
First time since Ronald Reagan.
First time since Reagan. Also, given some of the other folks that are in the cabinet, I think you could argue that you could go and find a qualified Latino. But it's going to be a problem, not just for him next time, but also for other Republicans in 2018 and in 2020. And I think, you know, in the electoral map, what you saw was that especially in Mexican-American heavy areas, in Texas, Hillary did 6.7 points better than Obama had done in 2012. You know, she won Colorado. She won New Mexico. She won Nevada. She improved from 2012 in Arizona.
He did marginally better than Romney did in 2012, though that admittedly wasn't very good. Let me ask you finally about your own plans. You are a politician who doesn't have a lot of places to go in Texas. Texas, as you said, is trended a little bit more toward purple in 2016, but still every statewide office holder is Republican. The legislature is Republican. There doesn't seem to be a place to go in politics. Have you lost your interest in politics? Are you regrouping? What do you plan to do with your time in the coming years?
Yeah, well, I mean, right now I'm working on a book for Little Brown that I had been working on before I got into the cabinet that they had given me an extension on. So I'm right finishing that. That's right. I'm speaking out and about and probably going to serve on some boards. But in terms of politics, I've said that it's very unlikely that I'm going to run for anything in 2018. My brother is going to consider a run against Ted Cruz for Senate, which would be quite a race, I think. So I'm just going to watch politics as they develop. It's been interesting for me that the times that I've been out of electoral politics, I haven't missed it as much as I thought that I would. I think it's possible, it's altogether possible that I'll run again for something. I won't lie to you and say that I don't think I'll ever run again.
Democratic Party's looking around for candidates for 2020. You think you could be one, yeah. Think you could be one of those?
I said the other day that I won't take that off the table. There's a long time between now and 2020. At the same time, I'm get focus on what I'm doing now too. We don't know what in the world is going to happen in 2018, much less 2020. So we'll see.
Well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to hold on to this tape. So that if and when you do announce your candidacy for 2020, we can say he raised it here at least second, if not
first. That's right. So. CNN or MSNBC got it last week, David. Second already. All you right. Got scoop.
Okay. All right. Well, in any case, even if we didn't get the scoop, it's always great to talk to you. Julian Castro,
thank you for
being here.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.